I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Thanks for joining us today. The U.S. has always been home for people with diverse faith traditions. It's enshrined in the First Amendment to our Constitution. A new survey by the Public Religion Research Institute found that while the U.S. remains a majority Christian country, there's a lot of churning, to use their word. 26% of Americans are now unaffiliated, meaning they're agnostic or atheist or nothing in particular. Those who attend religious services say it brings them closer to God, creates a sense of community and connection, and helps instill values in their children. So while religion is declining in the U.S., it's playing a dominant role in our politics this election season. Donald Trump is now selling God Bless the USA Bibles and using the phrase Make America Pray Again at his rallies that often resemble religious revivals. He told the National Convention of Religious Broadcasters in February, no one will touch the cross of Christ under the Trump administration. Our guest is Robert P. Jones, and he's the founder and president of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's written several books, including most recently, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and The Path to a Shared American Future. Robbie Jones, nice to have you with us on The Connection today.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And let me begin with this word religious, or these words religious churning. And this is how you describe and begin this new survey. Have we always had religious churning in America?
Well, we have, but I think the last three decades in particular are something quite new in American history. And we are in this latest report at PRI, we're really looking at the last 10 years, and you can even see a lot of switching, disaffiliation, a lot of things still going on even in the last 10 years. But this really began in the 90s. So we're really looking at, you know, what we're seeing now, a multiple decade of a lot of religious change. And the real headline here, I think, is the rise of the religiously unaffiliated in America that has gone, if we kind of go all the way back to the 90s when this first began, only, you know, less than 1 in 10 Americans were religiously unaffiliated. And today that number is more than a quarter. And that's something quite new in American history.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit. As you say, 25, you know, a quarter of the country is religiously unaffiliated. You know, the nuns, as they're often called, N-O-N-E-S, agnostic, atheists. Why leaving whatever their church is? Why the exodus from their faith traditions?
Yeah, well, it's notable that, you know, we ask people, we also asked people what their childhood religion was and what their current religious affiliation, again. And it's notable that when we ask it that way, that we have 1 in 5 Americans who left a religious tradition to become religiously unaffiliated. So that's quite a number of Americans, you know, who they weren't born outside of a religious tradition, but they chose to become religiously affiliated. When we ask people about their reasons for believing, you know, we get a range of answers. Some of them are that they just stop believing, you know, the tenets of the religion, or that their connection to religion wasn't that strong to begin with, that their family wasn't that connected growing up. So leaving maybe was more like a drift, you know, than a conscious decision to be made. But there are a couple of things that stand out that were the kinds of things that people are making explicit choices about. And there are really three that in that bucket. The one that's the biggest reason is actually that we have about half of the country, or half of the religiously unaffiliated, saying that they left a religion because of negative teaching about or treatment of gay or lesbian people. And that that percentage telling us that has gone up quite considerably. 10 years ago, it was 29% of the country who told us that they had left a religion for that reason. Now it's 47%. So nearly half of those who are religiously unaffiliated gave that single reason for leaving. About a third said that it was bad for their mental health. And that was a reason that they left their religion. And just a little bit less than a third named clergy sex abuse scandals as a reason for leaving.
Yeah, and that would be leaving the Catholic Church in particular. I'm interested in the mental health issue, what it was that they defined as their mental health, and what, I guess, whatever church or religious tradition they were affiliated with, why that was harmful or hurtful to their mental health.
Well, it's related in some ways to the LGBTQ question. We see more Americans who identify as LGBTQ citing that reason that they left because it was bad for their mental health. Younger people are much more likely to cite that. And then this is notable that 51% of former white evangelicals said they left because it was bad for their mental health. So much more likely than unaffiliated Americans alone. So it looks like it is, for many of them, based on more conservative teachings. And I think that for many of them, it ended up, younger people in particular who know a lot of people who are out and gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, and their religion was telling them, that these people were going to hell. And it created a lot of cognitive dissonance, I think. And many people responded to that by saying, look, I'm going to choose my family and my friends, and make kids feel like they had to choose that over their church.
I'm curious, with the unaffiliated, do they think of themselves or even call themselves spiritual? I mean, are they looking for something, perhaps to fill that void?
Well, we delved into that a bit, and it's interesting that we find that the vast majority of religiously unaffiliated Americans here fairly content to stay that way. We asked, for example, whether they were looking for a religion that would be right for them, and only 9% of people who are currently religiously affiliated agreed with that statement. So it looks like these are not seekers, to kind of use an older term, not religious seekers. They're people who have chosen to be unaffiliated, became unaffiliated, and aren't really looking.
Is there any way to know whether the religiously unaffiliated are engaged or less civically engaged, less socially connected with other people, feeling like they're looking for a community, but they can't find it? And I'm thinking even of this loneliness epidemic that we talk
Yeah.
about. Is that connected, do you think, at all to what we've been talking about?
It may be, and we've certainly historically, going back decades of public opinion, we have seen that church attendance, church affiliation does connect with things like voting, things like other kinds of civic engagement, volunteerism, that sort of thing. And some of that's fairly practical, that churches are often vectors for other volunteer efforts, right? They will pass around a sign-up sheet to go work at the food kitchen or something like that. So there has been those, or they do, voter registration drives. So there is that kind of practical connection there. I think the jury's still out on this, I think, about what the long-term implications there are. And certainly on voting, we have seen that gap has started to close, that we did see historically people who are religiously affiliated voting at much higher rates than those who are religiously unaffiliated. But in the last couple of election cycles, again, we have seen that gap close, at least in that kind of civic engagement.
We've been focusing largely on Christians and Christianity. I wonder, when you look at Jews or Muslims, are you seeing the same kind of churn?
It's notable that the biggest churn has actually been among white non-Hispanic Christian groups, and so, and particularly the disaffiliation dynamic that we're talking about. The biggest groups, that have been the senders of folks into the religiously unaffiliated have been white Christian groups for the most part. So we, for example, see the groups with the highest retention rates, and we have a whole chart on people with what the retention rates are on different religious traditions. And we see, for example, Jewish Americans have one of the highest retention rates in the country, and particularly over the, as we were measuring it over the last people who are childhood religion to current religion. It's a 77% retention rate, for example, among
Wow.
Jewish Americans today. The unaffiliated, by the way, we've been talking about them, also have a very high retention rate. That is, people who are raised unaffiliated, very unlikely to become religiously unaffiliated.
It's, I mean, that's an example of a good example of this churn that we've been talking about. One of the other things that you found was that half of Americans say that they pray at least once a week. And this is not necessarily in a church or synagogue or a mosque, but outside of religious services. And I wonder whether is that the sort of more casual, oh, God, I hope I got an A on that test, or is it, oh, dear God, please, you know, help my dying child, just to be overly dramatic here.
Well, you know, it's notable, and it's also worth noting that prayer does function differently in different religious traditions. So the groups that we see, and the way we asked it was that you have prayed personally outside of religious services, so a more personal practice. And that's important because, you know, we see groups like white evangelical Protestants, African-American Protestants, Hispanic Protestants. We basically see Protestant Christians scoring higher on that. And partially that's because Protestant Christianity encourages that kind of personal prayer life. We see Catholics and Jews, for example, scoring lower on there. It's not necessarily because they're less spiritual, but prayer tends to be a more liturgical or corporate practice rather than a private practice. But it is notable that, you know, there's still a lot of, you know, white evangelical Protestants, for example, you know, we have 82% of them saying that they pray once a week or more. So that's still a very common, you know, practice, even among, you know, even as these other kinds of affiliation measures have dropped.
Can we say then we are still a Christian country?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, certainly, demographically speaking, that is true. That demographically speaking, the majority is Christian. What's notable, though, is that, you know, the way sociologists and political scientists sort the American religious landscape is usually by race and religion. So we look at sort of white evangelical Protestants and African American Protestants, and that's because they behave so differently. Actually on the ground in political space and social space, also because of the history of segregation in this country, that the institutions remain fairly segregated. And so, you know, what I think is notable, and I think for our longer conversation, is that we have actually passed this churn has led us to pass a significant milestone of the last 30 years, and that is that even 30 years ago, we were not only a majority Christian country, we were a majority white Christian country. So just again, back to the turn of the 21st century, we were 54% white and Christian. Today, that number, though, has dropped. You take all white Christians together down to 42% white and Christian. And that's significant because there has been this kind of way of thinking about religion in kind of ethno-religious terms. That, you know, we have in a term like WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, that gets thrown around, you know, in common, you know, jargon. So I think that's notable that's there. And the big picture here again is that a lot of churn and even disaffiliation among white Christian folks, fairly stable among non-white Christian, and fairly stable among non-Christian religious traditions in the country, and growth among the unaffiliated.
Well, I'll tell you what, a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, taking a kind of snapshot of religion in America. And our guest is Robert P. Jones. He's the founder and president of the Public Religion Research Institute, and they came out with a pretty voluminous survey just a couple of weeks ago, and we're picking that apart. He also wrote a book most recently called The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are looking at religious churning in this country, and we will be talking in a bit about the role that religion, especially Christian nationalism, is playing in our politics this election season. And again, if you're just joining us, our guest is Robert P. Jones, founder and president of the Public Religion Research Institute. Robert, let me just get back to this survey, because it's just full of interesting nuggets about believers and non-believers. But it's interesting when you look at believers about the importance and the role of charismatic events, whether it's people speaking in tongues or divine healing of an injury or an illness, a direct revelation of God, the Spirit talking to someone. And I'm looking at your survey here. How do you understand, I guess, the power and role of some of these charismatic experiences?
Right. Well, this is actually something we haven't asked about a lot. So it's fairly new in survey data. But one of the reasons we're asking about this is because these practices have actually come to the fore really throughout the Trump era, that many of the religious leaders that were gathered around former President Trump, who we called his Evangelical Advisory Committee, came out of this charismatic or Pentecostal kind of either denominations or churches, non-denominational churches. And they have, you know, this, yeah, these ideas of kind of people speaking in tongues for prayer, belief in divine healing, direct revelations of God, modern day prophets. And that all fits within a kind of worldview that hasn't gotten as much attention, I think, either in the media or in even public scholarship here. So we want to kind of give ourselves some a sense of that and how that, you know, operates in our politics today and just what we should understand about this, you know, less well understood phenomenon.
So how should we understand that?
Well, you know, I think it's notable that when we look at people who kind of hold these views, they tend to be more Republican than Democrat, but they do transcend race. So we have white evangelicals, but also African-American Protestants who have either experienced these or believe in these sorts of things. You know, one thing that's notable, though, is that they do correlate fairly tightly with adherence to Christian nationalism in the country. And I think that's been one vector through which Christian nationalism has come into our public life, has been through some of these practices. There's a group called the New Apostolic Reformation that is known for many of these practices. And many of the leaders around Trump have kind of come out of that movement. And part of it, you know, is this kind of Christian nationalist thread that comes along. And we can see a tight correlation from that in the data.
How should we understand Christian nationalism? What's an easy definition for us?
Yeah. You know, it's a term that it has come into, you know, use, I think, in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. Look, I think we can really boil it down to this. It's a very old idea. So even though the term itself is fairly new in our vocabulary, it really comes down to this, a very old belief that the United States is divinely ordained to be a kind of promised land for European Christians. I think that's what it really comes down to.
And it's called the Doctrine of...
Discovery.
Well, discovery, yes.
The old roots of this go way back to before the founding of the country, in fact. And so in my most recent book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy, the hidden roots, this reference in the title, is that what really gets this idea. We often talk about white supremacy, but it's always actually a little bit more than that in the American context. White supremacy has always been wrapped up, not just in a racial claim to superiority, but in a religious claim to superiority. And what's justified that racial claim to superiority has always been a theological assertion. And that is that European civilization and Christianity were superior to other civilizations and other religions on the planet. And this is backed up in this, it's a set of 15th century church doctrines that came out of the kind of great age of exploration, right, where European powers were first encountering indigenous people in the Americas. And they actually looked to the church to give them some moral guidance on what their responsibilities were. And the churches actually gave them sanction because these people were not Christian to steal their goods and occupy their lands. And the documents themselves, one that was issued in 1493 in response to Columbus's voyage in 1492, actually specified that the church gave those European explorers, you know, the rights to submit their persons to perpetual slavery. Kind of spelling that out. But it all is kind of baked up again into this idea that the Americas, as these quote unquote, you know, newly discovered lands, We're really a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians.
Well, and going from 1492 or 1493 or even 1619 to 2023, PRRI, in partnership actually with the Brookings Institution, did a survey, the Christian Nationalism Survey. And here was the question, or here was the statement, God intended America to be a new promised land where European Christians could create a society that could be an example to the rest of the world. That was a statement. 30% of all Americans agreed with that. 52% of all Republicans agreed with that. 26% of independents agreed, and 17% of Democrats. I mean, you can see the partisan split on this, but nonetheless, that's a powerful belief to have, especially in 2023, 2024.
That's right. You know, we asked this question to try to get at, you know, to answer the question, well, look, you know, if this is the version of Christianity that lands on these shores, if it makes this claim 500 years ago, how live is this today, right? Because it may sound kind of quaint to say, okay, well, there's this set of 15th century, you know, papal bulls that kind of make these theological claims about European superiority and Christian superiority, but that sounds like pretty old, and can you really draw a straight line? And so we asked that in a contemporary survey, and yeah, you're right. We find 3 in 10 Americans still hold that belief. It's and if you think about it, there's ways to connect the dots that make this seem less fantastical. Like one basic idea that is directly derived from the Doctrine of Discovery and those old papal documents is the idea of manifest destiny. Right. This is something that, you know, many of us got in our history books, you know, in our childhood, this idea, right, that there was, and, you know, right underneath that idea of manifest destiny is an idea of providence. So what does destiny mean? Well, it means that, you know, it is meant to be. Who and to kind of keep unpacking, well, who is it that means it to be? And the answer to that is God. From this worldview. And as you said, it still has a hold on a majority of Republicans today. And in the religious world, it's a majority of white evangelical Protestants as well, who are, of course, you know, about a third of the Republican base today. So you kind of understand why these claims and even something like Make America Great Again, that mantra, you know, has this deeper resonance that it's nostalgia, and it is about this kind of older vision of America, you know, as a kind of white Christian America.
But you also say that belief in this Christian nationalism is also tied to denials about structural racism, is tied to anti-Semitism, anti-immigration, anti-LGBTQ, also beliefs in patriarchy, beliefs in conspiracy theories, support even for political violence. Put that together for us.
Yeah, that's right. So in this larger survey that we did with the Brookings Institution, you know, we were able to kind of measure Christian nationalism. And I should say, we didn't ask people to self-identify with that term, but we asked them a set of questions that would allow us to classify whether people qualified, right? And so we asked people questions like, do you believe that U.S. law should be based on the Bible, that the U.S. should declare itself a Christian nation, that if we move away from our Christian values, we won't have a country anymore? Like those are that Christians should exercise dominion over other people in society. So those kinds of questions were how we classified people. And again, about 3 in 10 Americans either are full-on adherents, completely agreeing that, or sympathizers, mostly agreeing with those sets of statements. And then we were able to ask a bunch of other questions about structural racism, like a belief that past discrimination in the country still has implications for racial minorities today. So denials of that, anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Semitism, as you said, all those things that we are actually, you can measure in the data, positive correlations there. And, you know, perhaps one of the most disturbing ones is the belief in that political violence may be justified, right? That people who adhere to these views of Christian nationalism are far more likely than those who reject them to believe that things have gotten so bad in the country that true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to set things right. And, you know, again, that sounds kind of shocking, but if you think about the belief that you're asserting here, if you really do believe, right, that God has reserved these lands for European Christians, and that's an actual belief you hold, it looks like that's slipping away. It does open the door for protecting that, really, with almost any means necessary.
Well, and just to drill down a little bit, you found that an overwhelming majority of Americans believe that democracy is, quote unquote, at risk. But then 25% of Americans think that American patriots may have to resort to violence to save the country, which raises a question about January 6th. And there certainly were a variety of different flags that were flying that day. I mean, do you see Christian nationalism and January 6th as kind of hand in glove?
I do. I wrote a piece on January 7th, in fact, saying that was titled, Taking the Christian Symbols at the Insurrection Seriously, because there were, alongside of, the ubiquitous Trump flags were both Confederate flags and the Christian flag. And, I can say, as someone who grew up in the evangelical, church in the South, I saw that flag up on the stage right at our in our sanctuary every Sunday. It's a white flag with a blue canton in the corner and a red Latin cross in the corner. And that flag was marched into the breach chamber at the House, along with the Confederate flag and Trump flags. There were plenty of, Christian T-shirts, Christian hats, other kinds of, Trump is my president, Jesus is my savior things, a big cross. Many people have seen that, a cross being erected and a gallows being erected, all of that. And it all kind of went together. I think that's the thing. These were not people in opposing, movements or any tension between them. There was this sense that these things were all working together. So, absolutely, there were people singing religious, Christian songs there and on the grounds as well. So I think we really have to take this seriously that, and that really it does point us to a fundamental question. And I think it is one that, we're going to have, we have never honestly made a full choice about this question. And that is, do we honor the idea of religious liberty, as you mentioned at the opening of the show, and the First Amendment of the Constitution, promising, religious liberty and honor the country as a pluralistic, religiously, racially pluralistic democracy? Or do we give space for this older claim that the country is essentially a white Christian country and everybody else is here as a second class citizen?
Well, and I'm curious because what we're talking about when we're talking about Christian nationalism, it's a small percent of the country. I'm not sure how big it is, but I know it's not a majority opinion. How do they have so much power and influence?
That's a great point. So, that's right. So in our surveys, we're finding about 3 in 10 Americans, right, who embrace these Christian nationalist views, define the way we're talking about them. But that does mean that by a margin of 2-1, right, the country rejects this view. The challenge is that it's not evenly spread. So as we mentioned, it's a majority of Republicans. It's a majority of white evangelicals who form the core of today's Republican party. And so there's a kind of double amplification that happens through these partisan lens. So particularly white evangelicals, who are some of the strongest supporters of this view, again, now are almost entirely loaded into one of our two political parties. So they make up about a third of the Republican Party base, and then they amplify it through that partisan structure. And I think the MAGA movement, the Make America Great Again movement, has really baked this in very clearly. As you mentioned, you can't see this anywhere more overtly than some of Trump's recent actions. So hawking this God Bless the USA Bible, if ever there was an artifact of white Christian nationalism, that's it. And these remarks, that he not only said, no one's going to touch the cross under the Trump administration, but he, and this was his speech to white evangelical Protestants, that's who that group is, and he was saying, we have to bring back our religion, and under me, you're going to have more power than you've ever had before. And was making those kind of promises to that particular white evangelical group. So it's an explicit appeal to dominance, to power, through his presidency. So I think that's how it's getting amplified.
And how do his supporters, his mean Trump supporters, his followers, how do they reconcile his behavior and his pronouncements? Bragging about being rich.
Yeah.
Bragging about sexually assaulting women. His hatred for migrants and immigrants, for people who criticize him, for people who are disabled or have disabilities. The lies that he tells almost every single day. If one is a card-carrying Christian, how do you reconcile that?
Yeah, it is a great conundrum, I think. But I do think we have some clues about what's going on. So I think what's happened here is that, historically, when politicians talked about their faith, we're thinking like John F. Kennedy or Obama, I think, talked a fair amount about his faith, or Reagan, or, there was a way in which they were evoking that to tell you something about their character, to tell you something about their values. It had content to it. It had kind of theological, moral content to it. So they were using that in a way to say, I'm a moral person. You can rely on me making good judgments. That sort of thing. I think what's really shifted here with Trump is that we've moved really from having the kind of religious references away from it having a kind of theological or moral meaning, that it really is about a kind of holding up of a religious totem that signifies tribal identity. And that's really what's happening here. I think, it's clear that, while Trump is hawking this Bible, we have multiple, interviews where it's clear he knows not much about what's inside the cover.
No.
Of that Bible, right? He doesn't even know how to say Second Corinthians, right? He can't pronounce it. He doesn't know a single verse that he could cite that's important to him when he's been asked. And in interviews, stumbles every time he's asked about any kind of religious content. He said he never saw the need to ask for his forgiveness for his sins, for example, which is like fundamental, Christian, kind of a threshold Christian teaching to call oneself Christian. But I think what's happening here is that when he holds up a Bible, which he also did, when he marched across the street and cleared some protesters so he could stand in front of a church, right, and hold up a Bible during his presidency. And so here he is again, holding up a Bible. It really is a kind of functioning more as a kind of totem of tribal identity than it is a signal to any theological or moral content. And I think that that's part of what's going on. And part of the reason why that works, I think, is that there is this sense, again, and it ties to this longer story of the doctrine of discovery. If you believe that you are part of the group that God has ordained to be in charge of this country and to be in power, and you find yourself in a demographic minority, it creates a lot of dissonance here. And I think it creates a crisis. And I think that's where many conservative white Christians are. They've experienced this crisis of this belief that they were supposed to be the ones in charge. The country has changed demographically fairly dramatically. Today, for example,
all white Christians. We got to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We'll pick up where we left off. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marnie Mosco, and again, talking with our guest, Robert P. Jones. He is the founder and president of the Public Religion Research Institute, which came out with a survey earlier this month looking at religion here in the United States, why people are leaving their faith traditions, why they are staying, and the role that religion is playing in our politics. And again, he's got a book that came out just a couple of months ago called The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. Robbie, you were talking about this kind of tribalism, this cognitive dissonance. So for people who claim to be religious and Christian being willing to look aside for all the sort of a-religious and unreligious things that Donald Trump does and says.
No, that's right. You know, I think one kind of clarifying moment for me was actually hearing a debate between two evangelical leaders during Trump's first campaign. And it was Russell Moore, who at the time was at the Southern Baptist Convention, and Reverend Robert Jeffries, who is the pastor, early Trump supporter, pastor at First Baptist Dallas. And they were arguing, and Moore was making the point that it was not possible to support Donald Trump because of his moral stances, that he really didn't pass the sniff test, right, for a group that called itself values voters at the time. And Robert Jeffries, you know, kind of opposed that view. And he said, look, things are so dire in the country today that I want the meanest son of a you-know-what I can find in the Oval Office, and that's Donald Trump. And that's from the pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas, one of the largest, you know, Southern Baptist churches in the country. And I think there's a that kind of instrumentalism, this exchange of a politics of principle to and an embrace of a politics of expediency, where the ends justify the means, is you know what it's about. So yes, Trump is crass. Trump is not measuring up by these Christian standards. But he's kind of our bully, I think, is the and he's going to restore power for us, even if he's not one of us.
Well, I am no religious scholar, believe me, or biblical scholar. But it's interesting to kind of contrast the sort of Old Testament, New Testament view of Christianity. I mean, part when I hear and see Trump doing and saying things, I think, well, what would Jesus do, right? This is, of course, the New Testament. But I wonder whether there isn't something kind of Old Testament, only I can fix it, a kind of wrathful God, a dictator God, if you will, that that's what we're dealing with.
Well, I think it's more than that. And I think, you know, of late, particularly with his trials getting underway, his, you know, four criminal trials, he's actually leaning into some New Testament moral claims, kind of messianic claims. For example, you're hearing him repeating now. He said this at that meeting of the National Religious Broadcasters, and heard him also repeated on the stump at his rallies. He's saying, like, I'm being indicted for you.
Right. I'm a martyr, right?
I'm taking the arrows. I'm taking the bullets, and I'm happy to do it. And when they're indicting me, they're indicting you. You know, and in evangelical theology, I mean, that's a kind of, it's called substitutionary atonement, right? That one, and it's usually applied to Jesus, right? That Jesus takes on the sins of the world. And Trump is explicitly tapping that logic in front of, you know, his evangelical followers.
Which means he has an instinctive understanding of how this works.
I think that's right. It's I alone can fix it. I alone can save you. Right. There's a kind of very straight line there. And I do think he's got an uncanny instinct for, you know, how to appeal to a group that, again, I think feels like it has a divine entitlement to the country, but yet feels itself marginalized and not in that space of privilege and power. And he's saying, you know, I'm the path to getting it back.
How much, I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but how much do you think abortion and the Dobbs decision has maybe inflamed people's, especially people of faith, in terms of where they stand on this issue and also seeing what's happening in one state after another?
Well, I think there's actually a lot of misunderstanding about where religious Americans actually are on the issue of abortion. For example, there's only one religious group in which a majority opposes the legality of abortion, and that's white evangelical Protestants. Hmm. They make up 14% of the country. Every other religious group, a majority of every other religious group, including Catholics, both white Catholics and Latino Catholics, including other white Protestant Christians, including African-American Christian Protestants, all have majorities supporting the legality of abortion. So it really is white evangelicals who are the outlier here. And it's also important to note that even when we've asked it, even for them, while it is a symbolic issue, There are not that many who actually support a full ban on abortion. In fact, like if you look at the states, there's no state where more than one in five residents of a state, including like the Deep South, support a complete and total ban on abortion. It's only about a quarter of white evangelicals who support a complete and total ban on abortion. So that issue, I think, doesn't quite function the way that I think the elites in the conservative, you know, white Christian world like hope that it functions. There's actually quite a bit of spread of opinion. In fact, the majority opinion, even among religious Americans, is actually for the legality of abortion.
So are we seeing then minority rule in certain, like in places like Arizona or maybe Alabama?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly right that we're seeing. And again, it's this kind of double amplification thing that happens because there's this one group, it's 14% of the country, but it's a third of the Republican Party. And then it uses that party apparatus to sort of become one of our two political party, you know, platforms. So that, I think, is how this gets amplified well beyond, you know, their numbers. And, you know, they have one of the two major presidential candidates for 2024 appealing directly to them.
I'm curious because we've been focusing on Christian nationalism and their view of America as a white Christian country, but they are up against demographics. We are a changing country when it comes racially, ethnically, and religiously. It's a losing proposition, it seems to me. So I wonder, you know, how much should we be concerned about them, and how much do we just sort of let the population, the changing population, sort of change the ethos?
Well, I think these things are linked. As I think, you know, one of the things that has set off this crisis was even if white, you know, conservative Christians, white evangelicals aren't like reading the statistics that are very, very clear. As you said, the trends are very clear in one direction. They are feeling it, right? They're feeling it in their children no longer affiliating with the churches that they grew up in. They're feeling it in their changing communities with what's on the shelf at the grocery store, which languages are spoken on the radio dial or on billboards, what their elementary school, public school classrooms look like. It's, you know, the change is very evident in the country all around them. And I think it is that sense of change that has set off this reactive, defensive move. And I think you're right. Ultimately, there's nothing I see that looks like these demographic changes are going to abate, right? They're going to continue by every measure that we have. The real danger, I think, is that what kind of damage can be done in the short term, right? While this group still has control of one of our two political parties, while this group has kind of the ear of one of our two presidential candidates. And, you know, it really is a kind of volatile cocktail. So, you know, I think if you kind of got and we see all of it. So, you know, if you have a sense of divine entitlement, you perceive an external threat to what you see as your rightful place in power. You believe in there are these conspiracies and Trump has sort of like moved these along, right? The belief that normal processes such as elections or court decisions are rigged by powerful interests or organizations. And then if you believe in apocalypticism, and we're hearing more and more of this appeal, you know, that we're living in a kind of special area of urgency where the normal rules don't apply. And you put all that together and you get a catalyzing agent like Trump, who's like literally, you know, positioning himself as a kind of messianic figure. And he's saying things like, if you don't act now, right, there'll never be another election like this, is some of the kinds of appeals he's making. This is a dangerous time, I think, because it sets people up to move outside of normal democratic processes. And we're hearing appeals to this by Republican politics, right? Take matters into your own hands. Right. And that's what you get, I think, in this kind of a worldview. People don't lose right, if they feel like God's will is being thwarted.
Well, we do live in uncertain times. I mean, there's a lot of churn, to use one of the words from your survey here, but there's just a lot of change, the pace of change, technology, there are more choices, there's more autonomy, and whether under those circumstances, a liberal democracy just feels too risky for a lot of people, and therefore an autocrat or a dictator or someone who can sort of tell you how to live your life has a certain kind of appeal.
I think that's right. There are these, and you know, what's notable is I think because of the changing demographics, we are in many ways being asked for the first time in our country's history, do we really believe the principles we put down in the Constitution? Do we really believe in religious liberty? Do we really believe in equality for all? And that's been the ongoing American question, right? So when the Constitution was written, it excluded women. It excluded non-property owning men. It excluded African Americans who were enslaved. You know, so it's been this ongoing question about whether we believe our better principles and can we live into that, I think, into the future. And we still, you know, our generation has got a role to play. And in many ways, the demographic changes have forced the question back upon us. Do we really believe it? Do we really mean it? And can we carry it forward?
I mean, does it require a certain kind of charismatic leader to help us truly, truly grapple with these essential questions about who we are as a country, who we are as a people?
Well, yeah, I think the crisis is going to force it. And you know, it's notable that, you know, we've been talking a lot about Donald Trump, but, you know, even in President Biden's addresses, and, you know, I think that President Biden would like to talk about his accomplishments, right, and the policies and that kind of thing. But I think, you know, it's, you'll see or hear it, he's starting to talk about and has talked about the soul of the nation, right? And I think that's what he means by this, these kind of very basic principles that are at stake here. By the way, he's also been the president who has most frequently said the words white supremacy in his public speeches. And I think that's actually notable too, that naming it very clearly of the problem that we're struggling with has been, you know, really, really important.
I'm looking at the second half of the title of your book, and the path to a shared American future. And you do talk about places like Tulsa and other places that have been the sites of all sorts of violence and intolerance. That there are things that are happening that should give us some kind of hope that we can grapple and deal with our history and with our amnesia about our history. Mm-hmm.
Well, I do think I do end the book with some hope. And I look at three communities, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, and the Mississippi Delta, where Emmett Till was killed. And also way up in the north, Duluth, Minnesota, which had a not very well known, but pretty horrific lynching of three African-American men back in the 1920s. And in each of these communities, what the common thread is that there were groups of local citizens who decided, like, we need to tell the truth about what happened here. And in all cases, these histories were fairly suppressed at the local level. We need to tell the truth about what happened here so that our community can move on and move on in a healthy way, not in a way where we've suppressed something, but where we've been honest about it and we lay a foundation for living together in a different way. And in each of these communities, and none of these communities are like hugely wealthy or have all kinds of resources, they have done it, and they've done it across political lines, across lines of race. You know, Mississippi and Oklahoma are very conservative states, for example, with very fraught racial histories. And nonetheless, groups of citizens have come together and said, we're going to tell the truth. We're going to try to lay a foundation for a better future together, and have largely been successful.
It's telling the truth, but it's also repairing, right? Repairing the damage that was done.
That's right.
Or the hurts that were inflicted.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, telling the truth and working on ways to find how can we repair the damage, I think. It certainly can never be fully repaired, but I think finding ways, both symbolic and concrete, to repair the damage and to help that also helps provide some amount of justice that provides a way to move forward together.
You grew up in a strong faith tradition. Has your faith been shaken, like I think a lot of people over the last couple of years?
Yeah, it's you know, it's been a long journey for me. I mean, you know, I grew up Southern Baptist, and so, you know, my denomination has the you know, infamous history of being founded in 1845 explicitly to make enslaving others on the basis of the color of their skin compatible with the gospel, the Christian gospel. I mean, that was the genesis story of our denomination. So it's been, you know, a long, and every Protestant denomination split, by the way, right, over the issue of slavery, with Southern factions defending slavery from a Christian point of view. So I think it's been a long, long struggle. I think kind of hearing about these stories and spending time with folks in Oklahoma and Missouri and Mississippi and Minnesota has been kind of part of my own healing process, and seeing, you know, these inspiring folks, you know, doing things on the ground and helping to repair the damage in their own communities. You know, that in itself, I think, has given me hope.
Well, we always like to end on a positive note. Robert P. Jones, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Lovely to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, founder and president of the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI. And you can check out their new survey and previous surveys as well. You can just Google them online and download some of their findings. And again, his most recent book is The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Debbie Builder is the producer of The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.